afraid. Don't be afraid. Love can be dangerous when you're hanging by a thread. Put your trust in me, don't be afraid. Welcome to my web, boy, got you in my sight. Put you under my spell, wrap you up nice and tight. Nowhere to run, nowhere to hide.
Hello, everyone. It is a bright and early Tuesday morning. 10 a.m. is bright and early for a college student, which I can say that I am for just this one more week. Because this will be the final installment of Swing Politics with Big Mitch at 91.5 WMFO, Medford Tufts Freeform Radio, as I am graduating on Saturday. Sunday. this weekend. I am really excited for the show that we have today, and I don't want to spend all the time getting too sentimental, but there is... there's a lot that's been happening in politics, and so the thing that I'd like to start with today is the poll that made headlines, because we always have to talk about a poll and get really angry at that poll. A poll that made headlines over, when was it posted? I believe 2 days ago or yesterday, and that is the New York Times poll. The most recent New York Times poll. And the top line results for that New York Times poll were pretty devastating for the Biden campaign. If it actually held up, it would be pretty brutal. So this is a poll that was held, that was recorded from April 28th to May 9th, which is obviously very recent. And among registered voters, this poll showed that Biden was winning Wisconsin by 2, which is not a bad result. In fact, that's the only one that's good for the Biden campaign because it only goes down from there. Losing Pennsylvania by 3, losing Arizona by 7, losing Michigan by 7, losing Georgia by a whopping 10 points. And finally, a totally valid poll where Joe Biden is losing Nevada by 12 points. The last time that a candidate won Nevada by, I think, double digits was Obama in 2008. And I am skeptical that Trump in 2024 is the equivalent of Obama's campaign in 2008. So, yeah, color me skeptical with these results. But why? Why are they so strange? I mean, why would you have... Trump, why would you have Biden winning in Wisconsin by 2 and losing Nevada by 12? It's just inconsistent with how the national environment goes. And I think that it's sort of, you know, a deeper headline within the crosstabs where if you look at the head-to-head, so there's in this poll there is sort of a multi-person race where you include people like Jill Stein or Robert F. Kennedy Jr. or Cornel West. But if it's just a head-to-head, which I think sort of paints a better picture of where we're at in the climate right now, I think that focusing on the other third parties raises what their projected vote share is, when the reality is it will come nowhere near what they're polling at. So RFK Jr. is polling at 10%. That would mean that that a third-party candidate would get more than Ross Perot did in 1996, where Perot got 9%, which is the second highest watermark of an independent candidate in post FDR, I believe, except for Perot himself in 1992. So I think that when you're including third parties, the numbers get muddled, and especially in this Nevada poll, if you're looking at including third parties in the analysis, that Biden gets something like 27% of the vote in Nevada, which it makes no sense. So in looking at the head-to-heads between Biden and Trump, Trump wins young voters by 3%. He gets 23% of the black vote, loses the Hispanic vote by 3%, wins the suburbs by 1%, wins 37% of the vote in cities, and wins independent voters by 8%. So let's go back and sort of dive into this line by line and how crazy this is. And I'll repeat these things every week, and I hope to continue this show, and I'll get to that at the end. But I continue looking at these polls every week, and while people say don't look at the crosstabs because there's not a high enough margin of there's not a high enough number of respondents in that age category or in that self-defining or self-identifying independent category, or not enough in that racial group like Hispanics or African-American voters. I will continue to go into them because especially in New York Times polls, there are enough respondents where the margin of error is not like something like, 15-16%. It seems to be about a 5% margin of error among these groups. And by that logic, that means Trump wins in a blowout victory beyond the likes of which any Republican has seen since Reagan in 1984. Which I'm skeptical to believe. And I have to tell you, probably a lot of non-crazy Trump voters would also probably not believe. If Trump's going to win, it's not going to be by a blowout margin. But getting back to the point here with the poll, let's start with Trump is winning young voters by 3% in this poll. I believe it's something like, 43 to 46. In 2020, Biden won young voters by I think 22 points or 20, something somewhere in the 20%, 22, 28, something of that nature. So if that were to happen, that would, one, mean that all of the young voters or many of the young voters that voted for Biden are not voting for him again, largely due to the fact of the economy and the Israel-Hamas war. When we know that young voters are not voting based on the Israel-Hamas war, based on my show last week, that voters, even young voters, can't even cobble up around 5% of individuals that say that their top priority when they're voting is the Israel-Hamas war. And if Trump were to win young voters by 3%, it would be a major age depolarization. So that would mean that the young voters are getting far more Republican. And maybe older voters are getting a little bit more Democratic. That's what every poll has told me so far. And young voters, the biggest fear the Biden campaign has with young voters is that they'll sit out because they're not going to vote for Trump. But this poll tells us they're going to vote for Trump. It's very possible that that Biden loses a number of young voters just by them sitting out, and the young voters that vote for Trump continue to vote for Trump, so his margin improves with the group. But if you're telling me that the margin with that group is going to improve 30 points, you're looking at a major election realignment. I'm skeptical that that will happen. Because other election results that we have are not showing particularly major weaknesses for other Democrats among young voters. And it's very true that Biden has a lower approval rating than maybe, the senators in these swing states that are up for re-election or, trying to kick out a Republican. But it's not by such major swings. So winning young voters by 3% doesn't seem very likely. Biden will lose support among young voters maybe by 5 or 6 points. The question is, where is he going to gain that from? The likelihood is that he'll gain a couple points with old voters the most engaged, and he really only needs to improve 2 or 3 points with old voters to make up that same margin. So moving on, the next bullet point that I found was interesting is that Trump receives 23% of the black vote in this poll. 23%. The last Republican president that did the best with African-American voters was, I think, Bush 88. And he got around 15%. I am legitimately curious because it's either him or it's somewhere else, someone else. So, it was not Bush 1988. I believe then it was probably Bush Jr. 2004. No, it wasn't. But regardless, generally a high watermark for a Republican presidential candidate with African American voters is around 13%. That Trump got around 12% in 2020. He improved on his margin with African American voters from 2016 to 2020. So this poll is going to legitimately tell me that Trump is receiving 23% of the black vote. And this is not indicated anywhere in the election results in special elections or in primary electorates. Biden is not hemorrhaging support among African-American voters based on primary election results, which I know is sort of a very different metric to go by, but it's a tangible that we have. It's data that we have that we can work off of. You can see a very, very notable diminished support in Biden's numbers among Hispanic voters based on the primary. Based on the primaries, especially in Texas, you can see that Hispanic voters are not keen on Biden this time around. That doesn't seem to be materializing with the African American vote as much as the narrative would like to push that. That being said, we'll focus on the black vote, and the Hispanic vote is right up after it. So 23% of the black vote, again, would be indication of race depolarization. So this would mean that, in theory, Republicans would be gaining with minority voters and Democrats would be gaining with white voters. That's not what this poll tells us, because Biden does horribly with everyone in this poll. But 23% of the black vote would be shocking. That's nearly 1 in 4 black voters backing vocally with their vote, backing the Republican candidate, backing Trump, who's been on the ballot twice already. And he loses. And so to go to the next point, which is very similar, Trump only loses the Hispanic vote by 3%, 45 to 42%. Biden won Hispanic voters around 16%. By a margin around 20% to 20% in 2020. And Hispanic voters have been moving away from the Democratic Party. That is very much true. I think that they're a little bit, there's a little bit of nuance to that, because Hispanic voters are very different by the state that they're in. So in Florida, Hispanic and Latino voters are going to be much more conservative than maybe they are in Arizona or Nevada. So while these are uniform shifts, they're state by state. And so Biden can afford to lose more voters, more Hispanic voters in Florida, because Florida is not really going to be competitive for him. There was a poll that just showed him 9 points down. And like, yes, again, the polls can be off, but based on the fundamentals, Florida is not a gettable state. And so what his goal is going to have to be is to cut down his losses in with Hispanic Latino voters, try to boost his campaign amongst them in, you know, Arizona, Nevada, and then the sort of key precincts maybe in the Rust Belt. But it's the Sun Belt that has more of a Hispanic Latino population. But the fact that Biden would only lose them by 3% is truthfully shocking. Biden would only win them by 3% is shocking. Because it's just not going to happen. The way that these swings go is not in double digit numbers in back to back elections. So, will Biden lose support among minority voters? Yes, not definitively, but it's very, very likely, especially among Hispanic and Latino voters. But is it going to be a 20-point or a 10-point shift in favor of Trump compared to Biden? No. And so, again, it's an inconsistency with sort of how politics works and what this poll tells us. And this poll is a screenshot in time, which, yes, if the election were to be held today, I agree that Trump would win. We're not in the heat of the campaign season yet, is sort of the biggest factor here. I think personally my favorite part of this poll is Trump winning the suburbs by 1%. Last week on this show, I brought up the Pennsylvania primary. The Pennsylvania primary was between, on the Democratic side, Biden, Dean Phillips, who's the congressman from Minnesota who had dropped out and endorsed Biden, and write-ins, essentially just voting for uncommitted to support Gaza, I guess, and pro-Palestine, something of that nature, essentially, to protest the Biden campaigns, or to protest the Biden administration with the write-in. And on the Republican side, it was Trump versus Haley. And Haley and Phillips had both dropped out by then before the mail-in ballots had been sent out. So this was the first primary where we were really looking at how does Biden do with Democrats and how does Trump do with Republicans of their own party. And also, it was a closed primary. So independents could not vote in the Democratic primary, nor could they vote in the Republican primary. This was from registered voters on either side. And what we saw was, on the Trump side, that Trump was losing one in four voters in the primaries to a zombie candidate. Zombie candidate is one that has dropped out before the election and is not running anymore, and that was Nikki Haley. So if you're looking at Bucks County and Montgomery County and Chester County, which are the collar counties of Philadelphia, Trump only won 75% of the vote there. Haley won 25% of the vote, or around 20 to 25% of the vote in each of those collar counties. That's huge. That's huge within Republican Party ranks. And many of these, yes, might have been Biden 2020 voters because they're registered Republicans who maybe who voted for Trump in 2016 and then voted for Biden in 2020, and they won't vote for Trump again, but they're lockstep Democrats now. That might be true, but it's not all of them. And it is still indicative of the major weaknesses that Trump has in the suburbs. So for a poll to propose that he is going to win them by 1%, it makes zero sense. Because the sort of base of the Democratic Party, of course, right after the cities, because cities are sort of have been a little bit less good for Democrats in terms of their margin. Democrats have lost ground in I guess cities just across the nation, not by major margins, but by a couple points. And a lot of that has been the Democratic margins otherwise have been picked up by the suburbs. The suburbs continue to grow in support for the Democrats. Trump can't win them by 1%. I don't even think he won them by 1% in 2016. And Trump was at his peak in 2016. Along similar lines, Trump wins 37% in the cities. 37% is a crazy, crazy high number. I don't know how they define cities. I'm sure it's made up perfectly well. But all of this is not, for me, it's not a warning. It's not a flashing warning sign. All of these numbers. To me, it's more of a warning sign about this poll. Because nothing in it adds up. I mean, 37% in cities is unheard of for a Republican candidate. And will Trump gain in New York City? Yes, he will. But And will he gain in, like, Atlanta and other cities across the country? Yes. But not by, what, 15, 20%? These are just not, it's just not how voters operate. So that's sort of all I can say on that. And the icing on the cake is that he wins independent voters by 8% in this poll. The last time that Trump was on the ballot and won independent voters was 2016, and he won independents by 1%. A single percentage point, he won independent voters. And winning them by 8 would be matching Biden's margin of how, I believe Biden won independents by 8% or 9% in 2020, which would indicate this poll, frankly, this poll indicates that it is going to be a Trump sweep, and there is nothing that the Biden campaign can do to counteract it. Personally, I don't believe that. And I don't think I'm wrong in being skeptical about this poll. Because these polls' results are consistent with nothing in politics about over the last 25 years. It would mean racial depolarization, age depolarization, regional depolarization. And do we think all of these things are going to happen? And so people might wonder why I'm skeptical of polls. What I do appreciate about this poll is that it lines up with the narrative of Trump being ahead. And if Trump is ahead, then Democrats and maybe independents really need to turn out to support Biden. So in my mind, from here to the election, I will criticize these polls and also praise them for what they will do, which is that when people are watching the, you know, the nightly news or whatever, and there's a new poll that came out from whatever news source that they see, and they see Trump's leading by 3 points, 2 points, 4 points, Democrats and independents who are Democrats and registered Republicans who are Biden 2020 voters or registered Republicans who just can't vote Trump anymore are going to say, wait, this is the real deal. This is something that Trump has a legitimate chance of getting back into office. I really didn't think 2020 was going to happen. I can't imagine it's going to happen in 2024, but it might happen this time. I mean, that is what every poll is saying when we watch the news. That is what it's constantly saying. So if that's the case, we have to go out and vote. We just have to. We don't have a choice. That's what I think the Biden campaign is hoping for. And so I will get into sort of a deeper aspect of that facet of thinking in a moment. But what I also found was interesting in this poll was a little pro-Biden tidbit. Threw him a bone. The question that was asked was, how satisfied are you with the way things are going in your life these days? Very and somewhat satisfied reported 74% of the respondents reported that they were very or somewhat satisfied, which is awesome. And not very satisfied or not satisfied was 22%. So what this indicates is that people are doing pretty well. That the Biden administration is delivering, and that the economy is getting better, and people are satisfied. Now, they didn't ask them in this poll, but if they were to ask, what do you think about the state of the country, they would probably say horrible, and those numbers would be reversed. You'd have 22% that say the country is good, and 74% say we're on fire and burning. So I think that is good for the Biden campaign in the sense of just that if people are happy in their own lives and their livelihoods, then they're more likely to support your candidate. I think that the upsetness with the state of the country is just perpetual at this point. Like, it's just almost baked in. I just think post COVID, everyone's upset about everything all the time and nothing's ever good enough. So that was something that I found was good for the Biden campaign. And good news for Senate Democrats is that they're outrunning Biden by somewhere like 5 points on average. I'm not sure at this stage if that's going to be enough to keep their majority, especially because based on the fundraising numbers, they see the Republicans seem to be, they seem to be jettisoning, or sorry, I'm trying to think of the word for it, but they're cutting off essentially, all of the Senate races except for Montana and Ohio. McConnell has basically stated that he just wants a Senate majority no matter how big it is. And so the broad maps of the past where Senate Republicans were sent, where Republicans really try to get as many seats as they can, is kind of seemingly over, because the money that they've invested into Ohio and Montana nearly matches that of the Democrats in terms of, you know, tens of millions of dollars. And you look at Arizona and you look at Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania, and there's like no money there. There's zero money invested. And I mean, this goes for the Trump campaign in terms of the money that they're able to raise or invest in ads. And we'll get to that in a second. But the major takeaways from this poll is that we're not really sure what we're supposed to do with this information anymore. Doesn't seem like it just doesn't seem like it's something that's feasible or real. And we just keep watching, because every poll has intricacies, and there will be polls that the Biden campaign is very happy about in the future that just won't be realistic either. But color me skeptical about this entire New York Times poll. And so the only justification that I can have for this poll in terms of why are all the polls essentially so pro-Trump is that the respondents are not totally recalling the reality of the Trump administration. So in a New York Times Siena poll, I believe this one was from last month, they asked a question of how do the voters categorize the administrations in terms of mostly good for America, neither good nor bad for America, or mostly bad for America. Joe Biden, 25% say Biden was mostly good for America, 46% say mostly bad. For Trump, 42% say mostly good, and 33% say mostly bad. So essentially, everyone just has collective amnesia. And I mean, I could go on a rant of how the major media outlets are treating him with kitty gloves, but I don't know if I have the energy this time. What I'll say is that this points towards the idea that I had mentioned before, that everyone is just unhappy with everything in the moment they have it and is constantly looking for something better. Especially post-COVID with politics. That just seems to be the consistency. And if we look at the Trump administration, I mean, we don't need to go through all the failings, but giving tax cuts to the wealthy and major corporations, ending abortion access — they ended abortion access — gutting gun control regulations, removing protections for LGBTQ+, minority groups and Native Americans. Like, just the list goes on and on. And I just think we're at the stage of society where everyone is unhappy about everything because it's just easy to complain. I don't know what changed entirely. It's just a theory. But they'll be unhappy with Trump if he gets back into office, more unhappy than with Biden. Trump will be able to sort of claim all of the successes of the Biden administration in terms of the Infrastructure Act and the Build Back Better plan and the Inflation Reduction Act and the clean energy investments and the attempts to protect abortion access and the number of liberal progressive-minded judges that have been confirmed, because those are definitely two equal campaigns and administrations that the Trump administration should not have to sort of take claim for any of their failings. But the Biden administration should be railed only by the major media outlets, and Trump should get only news about his trials. And this is the next point is something funny, because this poll that says Biden's bad for America, Trump's better for America, in sort of a with rose-colored glasses sort of viewing it, this weirdly does mean good things for the Biden campaign. If Biden is perceived as bad for the country and is behind in polling, that would mean that when the campaign really amps up he's going to be able to raise Trump's salience, and as a bad leader and as an incapable executive, and highlight the achievements of the Biden administration, to be able to tell voters, this is actually what's going on. This is actually the situation. And this requires, though, this requires two major things. This requires fundraising money, number one, and number two, campaign offices. So, number one, fundraising money. For the fall, Democrats, for the presidential election alone, combined Biden campaign, Super PAC, have $130 million booked in ads. I don't know what the comparison is to cycles past, but quite frankly, doesn't matter, because Trump and the Republicans have booked $0 in advertisements. $0. That is not the sign of a particularly strong campaign. And so the Democrats and Biden campaign is going to be able to blitz Trump, according to what we have here. So the fundraising money, what it will do is it will allow for these perceptions to shift. In theory, they might not. And if they don't, then Biden's screwed. That's the simple answer here. But and that being said, you know, Biden has booked ads and has broadcasted them, and the polls have not shifted at all. Now, I don't know if maybe the polls are just broken again because they haven't figured out how to calibrate for election cycles or something of that or presidential election cycles, because they do well in midterms. I mean, not in 2014, but in 2018 and 2022, nonpartisan polls were spot on. So it's definitely sort of possible that Biden's booked ads and they're either not working, or, in my opinion, the more likely outcome is that people aren't really paying attention yet. And it's often not until around Labor Day that people start paying attention after Labor Day. The summer is not really a time for a lot of politicking, at least in terms of it being on people's minds, just because the weather's nicer and they want to have fun. I don't know. It's still too far from Election Day itself. But Democrats are blowing Trump out of the water in terms of fundraising. And that's not going to be great for Trump. And it's also very possible why Trump might be choosing a dark horse candidate that is sort of unexpected for his VP. And that is Governor Doug Burgum, who I believe raised his hand on the debate stage and said he would not vote for Trump if he was convicted of a major crime. Now, it's very possible that Trump will not be convicted of a major crime in time for the election. But Doug Burgum is a billionaire. He was the governor of North Dakota. I don't know if he still is. And he is a billionaire. So I think billionaires can provide a decent amount of money to their presidential campaign. And I think that's what's interesting, because in a recent rally, Doug Burgum was speaking for Trump, which is something that Burgum indicated he would not do on the debate stage, that he would not be a surrogate for Trump or something of that nature, given the disdain that he presented for him. So I think it's interesting how much Republicans really fall right in line behind Trump, regardless of what they say. Personally, Burgum is fine, but Tim Scott's a better choice for Trump's VP. And I mean, I think fundraising alone, Scott's a good fundraiser, and he's a good face for the campaign. I mean, Scott's an ace in the hole, and I think that Trump will end up choosing him. But he also wants someone more fiery, because I think, and this has been said by a lot of pundits, that Trump does not want a Pence redo. And I do think that Tim Scott is kind of very, very much similar to Pence, maybe a little bit more, you know, a little bit more extreme, and a little bit more has a greater amount of fealty to Trump. But he doesn't engage a crowd like maybe someone like like J.D. Vance would, or Vivek Ramaswamy. But getting back to the major point here, Trump needs to book ads. I don't know entirely what the campaign is doing, but that's going to be a really, really major problem for that campaign. So that's the first part about how Biden will raise the ID of his administration in terms of its successes, and also raise Trump's salience as just a despicable character and with a poorly managed administration. But the second part is campaign offices. Now, to date, I believe the Biden campaign has set up over 100 campaign offices, field offices across swing states. And this is huge because campaign offices allow for a base of location. They allow for people to properly organize and knock on doors. And specifically, Axios did a deep dive into Biden's field offices in Wisconsin. Speaking of the Biden campaign having over 100 field offices, Trump has zero. Trump has zero field offices. That's not what a winning campaign does. It's not how they operate. And so looking at Biden's field offices in Wisconsin, he does something really interesting, which I think is a very savvy move by his advisors. 14 offices have been opened. There are 46 total offices in Wisconsin that they've opened, which is a lot. 14 of them have been opened in Biden won counties. So counties that Biden won in 2020, he has at least one campaign office in. Three of these offices are in Milwaukee. Milwaukee is one of the two major sources of votes for Democrats in Wisconsin. It's vital that Biden maintain his margin here, and it's a very African-American heavy city. It's a majority minority population city. Milwaukee itself, the county might not be, but it's deep blue. Regardless of sort of the racial demographics of the county, it's a very, very deep blue county. And having three in Milwaukee is great, because the engagement that Biden needs is greater among those in the cities and among African American voters specifically, as well as Hispanic voters and Latino voters. So, this is, I believe, a very smart move by the Biden campaign to invest three field offices here. And comparing it to Dane County, he has two offices. Dane County is where Madison is. And that's sort of, Milwaukee is hemorrhaging population in terms of just looking at census numbers, whereas Madison and in Dane County, population numbers are increasing. And I believe Dane County has a greater population than Milwaukee County does. And so, you know, a question here might be, why would a county with a greater population, with booming numbers and an increasing and not a hemorrhaging population, have fewer field offices than Milwaukee County? And I mean, I think the major reason is that Dane is more of has greater sprawling suburbs and has been seen to improve Democratic margins over time. Democrats are not doing worse in Dane County. They continue to do better. So where they will lose ground is with Milwaukee, if there is not enough of an institutional sort of field organizing support structure there, because that's where it's needed the most. So three in Milwaukee, two in Dane County, and the other nine are in more rural counties. And Wisconsin's a very interesting state because unlike maybe a swing state like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin's rurals are very much pale pink. They're pink. They're not ruby red. Like if you take some county in rural Pennsylvania, it tends to vote for Trump maybe 85%, 90% for Trump. If you look at the rurals in Wisconsin, the rurals vote maybe 60 or 70% for Trump. And that's a marketable difference. That's a marked difference. It's very clear that Wisconsin has just different dynamics. And I think that because the Democrats have a very historical strong nature in. I mean, Democrats were very strong in the rurals in Wisconsin in the you know, decades past. And while that has shifted, it hasn't shifted entirely. And that's why Wisconsin will continue to stay a swing state for so long, because as the suburbs continue to get blue, the rurals continue to get red, and everything kind of evens out. So it's a margin of a handful of thousands of votes in that state. And so Democrats are able to win counties, the rural, a number of rural counties, not by great margins, but by, you know, a couple of points or 5-10 points. And Biden has put work into there. But the majority of Biden's field offices are in Trump 1 counties. 32 of the 46 are in Trump 1 counties. So the campaign not only needs to bring Democrats back into its fold, it also needs to shave off Trump voters. Or if not shave them off and convert them, just kind of have them stay home. And field offices, the best way that you get votes is with engaging voters, is going up to their door, knocking on doors, saying, "Hi, I'm with this candidate, and we'd like to talk to you about your vote." And many, many, many of these voters will be saying, "I'm for Trump, please, you know, thank you very much. I'm for Biden, awesome, we can't wait to support you." But there's a number of voters that are like, "I wasn't really planning on voting in the election," or, "I didn't know that Trump was running, that's really scary, I think I should vote for Biden," or something like that. And field offices, the ground game really makes a difference. And I think it's really, really lost on a lot of the punditry here and a lot of the polling here that we forget that Biden had no ground game in 2020. Biden did not have any field offices. He did not have door knockers. He had people calling, for sure. But the callers were getting voters that were Democrats. I believe the postmortem was that Democrats were more likely to be able to stay home and work, whereas Republicans couldn't. And so those that were picking up the phone were largely Democrats during the COVID pandemic. And so those were Democrats that would be sort of, and also that Democrats were the ones picking up the phone for polls. And that's why polls over-registered Democrats. So Trump had his ground game in 2020. This time, he doesn't seem to have nearly as strong of a ground game. So we're in a completely new political environment. We really are. And I think that it's undersold how much the Biden campaign is going to be benefited by the fact that they can be on the ground and have surrogates for them, not at a higher level by virtual fundraiser, but at a level by the individual, the person-to-person interconnection. And so I think that that's very important. So with the fundraising money, which Trump has not invested any in, and the campaign in terms of advertising, and the campaign offices, which Trump has not set up a single one, these are tangible things that are good indications for the Biden campaign that is not really spoken about too much. And so I appreciate this Axios look into the field offices, because the focus of the Biden campaign is everyone. It's not just his voters. But for Trump, Trump only needs a bare majority to win. He doesn't even need a majority. He can win without a majority, without a plurality. It doesn't matter. And he really only needs his voters. So he doesn't have to truthfully try as hard. So, yeah, the polls have indicated some funky things, and the data that we're getting from the Biden campaign in terms of its beefing up of its campaign structure and infrastructure is indicative of a campaign that knows what they're doing, at the very least. Now, the big question that I have is sort of going into the election, how is the economy going to look? I know that most recently we had an inflation report that was higher than we had all hoped for. And I know the inflation report is sort of the only thing that matters. So And also, you know, in combined with that report, the Michigan University Consumer Survey of Consumers, which is has been done for maybe 80 years, found that economic expectations and perceptions declined from April to May, which is pretty upsetting. The jump from March to April was really, really strong, and we were hoping that things were going. Now improvement is not a straight line, but it was a really good indication of where things were going, and the expectations have declined. So I think that, and I said this last time, that the economic indicators need to improve for Biden relatively soon, and I think that the Fed needs to cut yesterday the rates. It's absurd that they haven't cut the rates. So these economic movements need to happen soon for the campaign. Otherwise, it's not going to be something that they can run on. But yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting what this cycle is going to bring for us. And finally, tonight, we have a huge, huge election battle going on. That is in Maryland's Senate race for the Democratic primary. Now, I've spoken about this race before, and it is one that is a... I think it's going to be very interesting because of the dynamics of the two candidates. The two major candidates are Representative David Trone, who represents the westernmost district of Maryland, in almost the panhandle of Maryland, and Angela Alsobrooks, who is the county executive for Prince George's County, which is right outside Baltimore. Now, the reason why this is so interesting is that David Trone is the owner of liquor. I believe it's Total Wine and Spirits, Total Wine and Liquor, something like that. He's a billionaire, and because he's a billionaire, he has put $60 million of his own money into this campaign. And there was a millionaire clause, basically, that said that in the bipartisan campaign finance act that was passed in 2002. It was the McCain-Feingold Act that included a millionaire clause that those that wanted to contribute to their own campaign could do so up to $1 million. Now, Citizens United, I believe it was the Citizens United ruling that gutted that clause, and that basically, if you have money, you can self-fund your campaign. You can put in as much money as you want to your campaign. So David Trone, who is a multimillionaire, is able to put in as much money as he wants to buy this Senate seat. So this means paying for advertisements. This means hiring organizers and operations staff and whatever he needs to do. Flooding the airwaves, essentially. And so very early on in this race, it was looking like a blowout for Trone. However, what's almost more interesting is that the Democratic establishment, almost every side of the party, other than House Democrats, who are required to support, like in their sort of charter, essentially, that they're required to endorse their fellow representative in the House, every lockstep Democratic individual that holds power has endorsed Angela Alsobrooks. She is she's been endorsed by almost every senator that I can imagine, every Democratic senator I can imagine. The other Democratic senator from the state of Maryland has endorsed her. The governor of Maryland has endorsed her, Wes Moore. She has received so many endorsements from the Democratic Party, and obviously the party itself and Biden won't get involved because, you know, you don't want to make enemies with someone who might end up getting elected. And this race is very close. It's going to be a matter of a couple points. But these endorsements and the money that Angela has raised has allowed her campaign to remain competitive and, in fact, in a couple polls, lead David Trone. So the reason why this is so interesting is it's essentially a test of, can money truly buy a Senate seat? And, I mean, yes and no. Fundraising numbers are sort of almost, you need to raise a certain amount to be competitive. But at a certain point, you have diminishing returns. And so the question is, do those very small, you know, diminishing returns at this point for the Trone campaign overwhelm the organizing capabilities, you know, the organizing capacity and the, honestly, the good-natured candidacy of Angela Alsobrooks, who has worked as a county executive and worked for the county and been in local communities for a very long time. And I also think that it's very important that Maryland is a huge black population. And the two senators from there currently are both white men. So, the descriptive representation is an important thing. If people see people like themselves in office, they know that they can be there too. And I think that Angela Alsobrooks is a phenomenal candidate. But the fact is that like beyond her qualifications, there is an important aspect to be said for the fact that when candidates of color run, individuals that are of that same race or of that ethnicity can see themselves in that person and be more motivated to run for office. So it's beyond, you know, can money buy you a seat, which money should not be able to buy you a Senate seat, but it's also who's going to be a better legislator, who's going to be a better leader, and who's going to represent the demographics of their state more. And both Angela and David Trone are, you know, lockstep Democrats who have proved that they are very much in favor of the party's ideals. But there's one that's a multi-billionaire who has worked hard in a sort of corporate sense, which is great. And there's one that's consistently worked in the community for upwards of a decade or two decades. I think maybe even more than that. And to me personally, it speaks to politics not being about money, but being about providing for the people that you want to represent. And I think that Angela Alsobrooks does that best. But we're going to see if she can overcome this money machine that has been there from the beginning. Because Alsobrooks didn't have high name ID. She was not someone that was known in the state, but Trone was able to define himself very early. What I think he didn't do, because I think it would have come off poorly, was he didn't define Alsobrooks in a negative light. Because there's not really much negative that you can pull in from her. There really is very little. So Trone raising his name ID, trying to just get out there first. If you are the first one that has made an impact or an imprint in someone's thoughts on who they're going to vote for, then it stays in their head. It stays. They sort of might hear about another candidate, but they're like, no, but this guy almost solicited me first. He presented himself to me first. And first impression is a very important thing in the political game. So Trone has that upper hand. And on the other side, Angela has a stronger organizing group. Just the campaign behind her is stronger. And she has she just has a strong support within her community. So I think that it's going to be a very close race. And I hope that Angela wins. And I think she will win, which would be a huge win for the Democratic majority. Just as someone who is a good legislator who didn't buy her way into a Senate seat, who's worked for the people. So that's going to be something that I'll be watching tonight among another few, you know, nuanced elections. But this has been the final installment of Swing Politics with Big Mitch here at 91.5 FM, WMFO, Tufts, Freeform Radio. And it's been a pleasure to be able to speak mostly to my family, which is funny, but sometimes to the void when I had a 3 a.m. Slot and I would just speak about politics at 3 a.m. to no one. And so it's been really lovely to have a 10 a.m. slot, but it's also just been an amazing journey here. And I hope to continue doing this. I hope to continue being able to share my thoughts on what I feel is important in the political world, especially electorally, and what matters about elections, because a lot gets lost in the news cycle. A lot gets lost on the front page, especially when you have news organizations that only care about their bottom line and don't care about democracy. Because, I don't know, the Washington Post's Democracy Dies in Darkness is not so true anymore. Democracy dies in broad daylight by the Washington Post. So I think that it's important to raise these things and to provide a clearer outlook and also some hope for when the days seem bleak and dark in terms of the Democrats' hopes, because there's always institutional things and lurking data that can go to sort of prove the other side. So it's been an honor spending an hour here over the past year and a half, 2 years. And I can't wait to continue it in the future. Thank you all so much for listening. I really hope you enjoyed. And I will I'll catch you in the next podcast, which I'm sure you'll all hear about. So thank you so much, everyone, and have a great rest of your Tuesday.
There's danger out there. It lurks on highways and quiet neighborhoods. Chez eux.